Hey folks, and welcome to this week's podcast. Our guest is mastering engineer Greg Calbe. He's been on the program twice before, both in 2016. And if you need more, go to WFMU.org/Michael. Scroll down till you get to 2016, and there's two shows with him. And both of those, I think we talked more about his history, how he got started, his family life, stuff like that. Today, we're kind of just all over the map as he is, he's not retiring, but he's kind of slowing down, coming to sort of the end of his career, considering at least he's taking the summer off. So we'll see where this leads. But he was in a mood to reflect, and we sort of talk all about mastering and the history of how it's changed as technology has changed, the struggles, some funny stories about interesting musicians and producers that he's worked with. This is really all over the map, and I think super interesting for folks who are curious about specifically mastering or just fans of music. And he's worked with so many people over the years. There's just so many interesting ones. So I think there's something here for everybody. Super interesting guy. He was very candid, which I love, and nice guy, you know, talented, unique guy, and it's great to get this story. So enjoy this. It's just under 2 hours because we've cut the songs out, so I think you will enjoy it. This is me and Greg Calbe, and hope you're having a great summer. Talk soon. All right, two number one hit records. First, Nikki Lane Jackpot from Highway Queen from 2017. What a great sounding record that is. And after that, Yellow Tango, If It's True, from Popular Songs 2009. Both were mastered by Greg Calbe. And Greg, good morning. Welcome to the program.
Good morning, Michael.
How are you?
I'm good. I was early. I was an early bird today, an hour early. But thank you for bearing with me.
You got to explore the
Jersey City waterfront. It's beautiful. It's incredible. I'll be back.
It is kind of gorgeous down there, isn't it? I mean, people don't quite realize what... What a
no!
A great day for it, yeah.
Yeah.
When I say that Greg Calbe mastered those two records, let's just start off with that. I'm not sure everybody knows exactly what that means. Would you move that mic so it's like right on you?
Sure. Or
I'm giving you audio advice.
Better here?
Yeah, that's much
better. Okay.
What does mastering mean? What does it mean? What does it mean when somebody finishes a record and then hands it off to you?
Well, what it is, so mastering in most general sense is making a master that's going to be what the public is going to hear. So you're bridging the gap. As a mastering engineer, you're bridging the gap between what the creators have done up to that point and what the people who listen to the record in different medium and different eras, how they're going to hear it. So there's two things. One is just literally technically prepping it, but the more important thing is like deciding whether it could be improved. And this is why, me and maybe the 20 other mastering engineers that have been around for years and decades have found a way to enhance or improve even what some of the most talented mixers and recording engineers can do. And they rely on us kind of to check off different musical elements, different sonic elements. And you're kind of a judge, but you're a judge that is actually brought into the creative part also. So that's the essence of mastering. The ear that you develop is kind of a combination of a global understanding of bass, treble, mid-range sonics, but it's also musically, I can speak for the guys that I have always respected in our trade. There's a sense of musicality that different engineers bring into the work that has some type of a unity if you look at their whole career.
Mm.
And the other part of it is in mastering, part of being part of what I've been told that I'm good at is leaving things alone when they are already good, because there are a lot of people, especially newer people, that come into the business trying to make their bones or whatever, and they overdo it, and people come to us and go like, they just did too much, it doesn't sound like my mix anymore. So it's kind of getting an understanding of what that person who's your client, the producer, the engineer, the manager, what their taste is, what they're looking for, plugging that in technically to the technology of the time. And we'll probably during the course of the day, we could talk about different eras and what mastering did. But that's, if that answers the question.
Yeah. Well, somebody asked me, somebody emailed me, a listener said, I'm going to condense this. Should, when someone's making a record, should they leave room for the mastering engineer to do some work on it, or should they think this is perfect and then hand it to the mastering engineer?
It's an excellent question. Leaving room is something which is part of the era that we're in right now. Leaving room has to do with the technology, the plug-in maximizer technology that had been incorporated over the last, particularly over the last 10 years. But when there is no room to change something, to essentially enhance it, the engineer who doesn't leave room has to have a tremendous amount of confidence that that's the best it can be, because it will not be able to be improved. I can make him a master. And I have, I don't really want to name names, but I have a couple of engineers who are really good at that. At really good at not leaving room. Dave Friedman is one of them, a fantastic Dave Friedman from upstate New York. And the tiny little changes that I do to what he does, he feels enhances a little bit, but it's tiny, tiny, tiny. It's really basically the layman would not hear the difference as to what I do.
But you do have tools, literal boxes, outboard gear,
yes.
Very expensive things that do maybe one little thing that maybe the normal guy doesn't have in his arsenal. So when
if there is enough room, and we say room, we're talking about kind of like just volume, the amount of level on the mix, and people who go as far as to actually look at the files on their computer will see like almost like a ribbon effect as they look at a sound file. It'll look like a ribbon or, say a sausage. In other words, there's no dynamics visible. And those are really hard to put through analog gear. But if somebody gives me a little bit of room and I put it through a couple of my analog boxes, I can give something a more organic sound, a more natural sound. When I'm in the car listening on Sirius XM, so many times, I will hear something and it just has like a very artificial sound. And when I hear that in the car, I go like, oh, I wish I would have had a chance to do that particular record, because I probably got to breathe some of that naturalness, which I think that the human ear likes that. And I know from talking to people about sound in general, music fans, fatiguing is a word that I hear frequently. Why is everything sound so fatiguing? And back in the LP era, I never heard the word fatiguing even once. It just wasn't part of what we did, because LPs would have dynamics. They weren't judged. The quality of them wasn't judged by the amount of volume.
Yeah.
So we have such a different environment for listening now, for how people listen. You know, two speakers in a room with a receiver is like almost no one has that anymore. No, we had that for 25 years, but now
do you change your approach knowing that a huge part of, like, you mastered a Taylor Swift record? You got to think that a lot of the people are going to be listening to Spotify, which is, somebody uploaded a wave and then that got turned into, I don't know what kind of file they use, but it's it's a lesser file, and then it's streamed and that's a natural compression, and then it's put into your earbuds.
Yeah.
And I'm not saying that's a bad, it's a fun way to listen to records, but it's very different. Do you think that, do you approach that differently? And do you think that those generations who've grown up with that are training their ears differently? Are they going to get fatigued? Or are they not going to notice?
Well, again, that also speaks to like what you do, like inside the mix. When I hear something, if I was working on a Taylor Swift and I thought the vocal could have been mixed a little bit louder, I'm not saying that the one I worked on needed that, but I'm saying in general, I can do that. I can make it sound a little louder, which will translate through, whatever, Sirius XM, Spotify, any of them, Amazon, Apple. They all sound texturally different, but essentially the mixes are pretty much the same. The one thing that I've noticed from the mixers and from what I do in mastering, because things have more low end now. The low end is pushed because people listen on their phone, and the phone doesn't have anything under the 200 cycles. Different headphones, some headphones are tremendously heavy low end. The Beats headphones are really heavy in the low end. The Sony headphones are really light in the low end. The Audio-Technica one, they're more balanced. Everybody has different headphones. So the whole thing becomes a little bit shaky as to what your responsibility is. And the way I look at it, I always look at it, what does my client want his mix to sound like in his environment, in his world? Because if he has that confidence that it sounds better to him, I have a happy client. If the record actually does well, I'm given credit by the client a lot of times for helping it do well, even though I may not have had anything to do with that. But the low end is the difference in listen. Because I'm in the car and mostly on Sirius, I hear things with so much bottom sometimes I can't even turn them up. I mean, it's way off.
When you talk about Sirius, you talk about Spotify, which is those are both platforms that a lot of people are listening to. Yeah. You know, if they're playing, I don't know, you know, a Rascals tune followed by the Bee Gees, followed by Talking Heads, followed by Taylor Swift. Those are all mastered in different decades. They're all recorded in, so they've got to find a way to make those not sound in different universes. So they're applying something, some sort of
There's a level adjust that happens. I don't exactly know how it's done,
but it'd be like walking into a museum and they try to make every painting the same size or something.
I know, I know, the listening patterns of what people do. There's so much listening now that happens in it, not just in the car, but just walking around with headphones on, walking around with little earbuds. You kind of in that sense there is a move towards having a little bit more bottom, and sometimes that can boomerang on you, whatever. But it's one of the reasons why, as the years have gone on, I felt like creatively I had much less working from my heart, much less working from making this mix sound good, having to compensate for different things, and then also having to take something which I know, because of the way it was recorded and the lack of budget and the lack of expertise in the way it was recorded. And this is a longer conversation probably that we could have any time about budget, what the budgets have done, what our availability of 10 billion songs has done to people's budget to be able to make really good sounding records. So, you know, my job had turned into over the last 3 to 5 years, has turned into really making something sound less bad rather than really good. And it's not fun to spend, you know, 6, 7, 8 hours, sometimes 3 or 4 different projects, two songs, one song, 3 songs, different artists, and walk away after the day. And you know, somebody would ask me, like, what'd you work on today? I said, you don't want to know.
But
that's not what attracted me to be a mastering engineer.
In the early days, you would take a whole record and a whole album.
Yes.
I want to get back to that. Let's talk, you know, Nikki Lane Jackpot. I just love that record. I assume when that came in that there was nobody in the studio. Nikki Lane doesn't come in the studio. The producer doesn't come in the studio.
I would remember if they came in. That's why I have a very vague memory of it. I mean, I know I heard the song before, but you have to understand, sometimes you literally get 10 songs and you get 3 or 4 hours to do them, and you just kind of dig in on each one and you send it back to the client. And, you know, if there's no interaction, you have nothing in the memory bank other than the fact that there was a good song or two on that record.
But I think part... I could never do your job, and I think so many people couldn't, because they cannot have... What you're doing is such a subjective thing, like you talked about earlier. Each guy has their own set of ears, and you're going to do what you think is best. But there's also this objectivity that you have, which is what you said before. I'm going to make every record sound a little bit better, no matter what it is. You're going to say, how do I make this sound better? And because that's... I couldn't do that. I'd be like, this is garbage. I hate this, right? And you are, that is one of the things that's kept you in business. So when did you master your first record?
1973 was my first masterings at the studio I worked at in New York City, Record Plant. I was hired to kind of be a general studio helper and also to be on the remote truck. Same thing, dragging the wires around, setting up the stage for the microphones, packing up the mic, driving to the gig, you know. And then I got into the studio as a helper across all of that. We had three recording studios, and they would record mix rooms. They were big rooms, big record rooms. And then at the same time, one of my dear friends in life was starting to do some disc cutting. which was also part of the operation at Record Plant, and I started to gravitate to helping him. He needed some help on stuff, so I would help the engineers in the studio, and then I became like a studio assistant for about a year and a half, and then started to be more of a mastering assistant. And the year and a half in the studio as studio assistant gave me a fantastic understanding of recording, which I feel bad for a lot of the newer...
Like, what sessions were you assisting on? Like, what?
Lou Reed, Berlin was one.
So you sat there and operated the tape deck or helped set up microphones?
Operate the tape deck before the automation that enabled you to just go to a certain section of the song. You had actually used a crayon, a China marker, and used to write on the tape as it was going. You make a little squiggles as to where the bridge was, where the first chorus was, you know, and then because people didn't want to wait to hear the thing go... So that was, you know, that was kind of the beginning of understanding what mixing was about. But it was all me observing. It was all done by observing. We didn't have any kind of program there to teach you about recording. You had to just watch. You know, so if you went to a room and Shelly Yackas, one of the greatest engineers ever, was doing drums, he would have me go out into the room and he would just hit me. I'd hit the bass drum like 100 times while he was fooling around with the equalization or the compression that he was doing on the drums. You know, so you know the way the setups were for different engineers. Really learning about recording from watching. That's basically how I started. But the thing about being in the cutting room at the same time that was, I thought was a perspective that I had that maybe a couple of people never had, was I would see while I was assisting somebody in the studio this tremendous amount of confidence in how great the mix was. Everybody kind of patting each other on the back, and this is great. And then that same engineer coming up to the cutting room and going like, do you think the bass is good? Do you think the vocal is good? And, you know, I mean...
Is that about human nature, or was that about, you know, just trying to keep the client happy during the mix?
Yeah, it was human nature to keep everything positive. It's very important to keep everything in recording, whole process.
Yeah.
I think the really good engineers know in their heart what's good and what's bad, but keeping the vibe positive is really important. And I've carried for the 51 years that I've been mastering, I very rarely try to have to put a negative twist on anything. Once you put a little negativity in something, it really throws everybody off. And I'll tell you a funny story about Lou Reed.
He was negative? You're kidding me.
Oh, yeah. Well, there's so many Lou stories. But this is the one that I think was, to me, it took me years to kind of understand this. But I had done a whole bunch of Velvet projects for him through Polydor at that point in a reissue. And we had a very good relationship. And I did an album for him called New Sensations, which a friend of mine produced and recorded. Very good vibes all around. Another album came in that he was working on, and it came in digitally, and it came into my room after it went through the then very primitive kind of assembly process, where the whole album is now on this video. It's basically on a video cassette. So I'm listening to the video cassette. Lou is on the couch with his bass player. I'm listening to it. I don't like the way it sounds. Something is not right. Something happened somewhere. It just had the wrong sound, and I knew it did. And I thought I was doing him a big favor, because when he woke up, I said, Lou, there's something about this that doesn't sound right to me. And what I'd like to do is I'd like to, next time you come in, let's get the mixes up here instead of the compilation and see if there's a difference. So, you know, it's what I do as an engineer. He was supposed to be in a couple of days later, canceled the session. About maybe 2 weeks after that, I'm leaving the studio and I see him in the hallway. And this is after knowing him for like 5 years. He sees me. He's got a shopping bag with him. He sees me and he turns away and he doesn't say anything to me and pretends he didn't see me. What happened was, okay, so he took it somewhere else. He started working with Bob Ludwig. He might have worked with him. And Bob's a great engineer. The thing is, it took me years to understand, and somebody told me, you have to understand one thing about Lou. He's superstitious. If he feels that something is off, he'll make a turn. So they use that word superstition, and it really struck me as the same thing I kind of inherently understood. You don't put a negative. If something doesn't sound good, you don't say it doesn't sound good. You say it needs something. You're improving it, but you don't criticize. And there are mastering engineers who are very critical very, very famous, popular ones. Doug Sachs was one of the most famous West Coast, phenomenal, one of my idols in terms of mastering. And a friend of mine brought him a tape one time, and he listened to the mix. And the guy said, "Well, Doug just spun it right off the machine, and good effing luck." And he threw the guy out of the studio. So that was it. And he had a career that spanned probably 40 or 50 years also. So it's just, again, keep it positive.
I want to get into a little bit.
Sorry for the F word.
How you started. Hopefully I beat it. I want to get back to how you started. But let's.
Yeah.
I brought a bunch of records from my house and some from the WFMU library, and you brought some. And when you saw this one, you said, "Oh, I got a story about that one."
Yeah.
This is Keith Richards' Talk Is Cheap. I guess it's from the late 80s, early 90s?
Yeah, I would say like 88, 89, something like that.
What's
the
story?
And we did a reissue. Well, that one was one of the most, probably did more processing on that in the original album than...
Why?
I mean, I sort of... Because the mixes were...
Was it mixed to tape?
It was mixed to tape.
So somebody brought you half-inch tape, quarter-inch tape? What are they
doing? What did we say, 1989? It probably was half-inch at that point. But the mixes were whacked out. There was something wrong with the mixes. They were very dull. They weren't very present. The music was all there, but we twisted and turned those dials for hours and hours.
And who's
hours.
We? Who's sitting in the room?
Well, Waddy was in the room. Steve Jordan was in the room. Steve Jordan...
He's a co-producer and drummer on this.
Yes.
Co-songwriter, I think, yeah.
Yeah, Steve Jordan basically, and Keith had long relationship, and everybody knows he's in the Rolling Stones now, and he's the drummer for the Stones, right? So Steve and I have done records for, I think, more than 30 years, going back to, what was that, the horse you rode in on? I forget the name of it. That's Dave Perner's band. So anyway, it needed a lot of processing, okay? So now flip down to about 3 years ago when they were going to do a reissue, an anniversary reissue, and I had the LP that I had cut back in those years, and I had the tape that I had worked on back in those years. And I swear that no matter how hard I tried, I could not make it sound as good as the original that I cut. And I had to try to understand. And what I've determined, and this happened on a couple of other projects, but not so obviously, is that tape itself loses vibrancy. It's a magnetic tape. If it's not kept in proper, even if it's kept in proper storage, if the tape stock originally was not that good, if the machine was not aligned properly, there's all kinds of elements. So anytime I see something in an antique store or an old used record store from the 80s of a classic album, it's worth whatever they, it's worth $30. It's worth $50. If you love that record, buy the original one. Now, I don't want to sabotage the work that I did 3 years ago, but I just want to tell you that, and I'll just say it, I never could get back to what
that
it sounded like back
then. That
is
fascinating, yeah.
I couldn't get the overtones, the highs, the imaging. There was just something that I couldn't get from that tape that I had to work on that day. It sounds really good. But, now that I'm not working as much anymore, it doesn't matter if they don't use me anymore. But damn, I've tried real hard. That's all I can tell you.
Let's hear, this is from Talk. I think, I'm not sure I got the right song queued up because I can't find my glasses.
Oh, man.
But if not, we'll re-queue it up. There it is. All right. Right back with Greg Calbee after little Keith Richards. Yes, there is the great NRB Hue. That is from the vinyl there. Of All Hopped Up. Boy, it sounds fantastic. Mastered by Greg Calbee. And before that, we heard from Keith Richard. NRBQ. When I was looking through your credits, and I will say that there are something like 6,500 credits on discogs.com, which is a great resource. I think I don't know, how many, do you have a number of how many projects you've worked on? Is it possible?
Just doing the math of how much we used to do for so many years up until kind of the last... the last 5 years when everybody was kind of EPs and, post-LP era or post-long-form era or whatever. But I'm pretty sure it's over 8,000. It's between 8,000 and 8,500.
A lot of records.
It's a lot of records. And, because I worked full-time, I'm 76 years old, so from age 23, I listened to music pretty much 5 days a week, 8 to 10 hours a day. For that many years, I'm not sure if there's anybody that listened to more music, but they may not be, because that's a lot of hours, because it was so steady. You know, it was just so, I mean, I basically got a paycheck consistently since I was 23 years old.
I mean, when you would get in the car, would you turn the radio on when
you're
driving
all the time.
Home? So
no, I was, you know, I up until recently, I've just been a complete fanatic with listening. And I, you know, I'm just always looking for new inspiration from new artists, and but sometimes what I determine as a new artist, like Ray LaMontagne, is not a new artist, and I always loved his voice, but now I find myself gravitating to his stuff, and he's been out for 10 years, so that's like for me that's like kind of like a new artist.
Well, as I was going through these lists and pulling records from my own collection and from the library here, some of them that you are credited with, you're not. Someone else's name is on the record. Some of them, there's no name on the record. And then in the inner groove of the record, sometimes it's almost hard to see.
Yeah.
The word Sterling is kind of stamped in there.
Yeah.
And then in the run-out grooves, usually what is written, you know, that's after the last song, there's a little bit of space. And usually in there is carved the release number of the album or some sort of identifying thing that so they can match this piece of, you know, the stamper to what project it is. But then sometimes people write messages in there. Did you have a signature that you put in there?
What I would do was that we had a stamp that said Sterling, and the stamp, we just press down. You know, it sounds easy, but if you hit the stamp and it hits the lead out groove, you got to recut it. That's 20 minutes out of your life. So you really, you know, and if you were tired, you know, but it would say Sterling, and then I would put a little GC next to the Sterling. I think I did that eventually because we had other guys that were doing stuff. You know, obviously our other engineers, we had three or four other cutting guys, right?
Yeah.
So I would put a little signature. So,
but if we're looking for your signature on a record, look for GC.
GC would be me for sure. But a lot of the stuff that I did was just Sterling. It said just Sterling. But when I, you know, I was talking to the NRBQ guys. I'm pretty sure it was Terry, and I was telling him about this, and he said to me, let me ask you a question. Is there any way that you could do like a little drawing in the space? I said, well, it's kind of a small space. What do you got in mind? So he said, is there any way that you could draw like a little picture of a cock and balls? And I was kind of like, well, that could be fun. But my first impulse was not about the cock and balls. It was about, am I going to screw the side up and have to do it again? So I actually did, and we sent it out, and the pressing plant wouldn't press it.
Because they
saw the drawing, and they thought it was obscene, and they would not press it. And I had to recut the side, and we build the client, and I had to do it without the cock and balls. Now,
what other stuff do people put in there? What
girlfriend thing, heart with a girlfriend's initial on it, a word or two that means something. It usually had to do with relationship stuff,
and it was a little secret message to your
yeah.
Girlfriend.
So you could say to your girlfriend, hey, if you checked my album out, blah blah blah. Yeah, I mean it didn't happen that frequently, but the funny thing about the NRBQ thing, I told that story a couple of years later to a producer who was working on it. Pat Travers was the artist. It was on PolyGram. It was a rock, you know, rock. It wasn't indie. It wasn't songwriter stuff. But I told him about it, and he said, I want you to do that for my record, and it didn't get stopped. So somewhere out there in the
there's a Pat Travers record with a secret message in the I want to point out that Greg has been a guest on this show June 11th, 2016 and October 8th, 2016. So if it seems like we're skipping any of the story, you might check the archives for those two shows to get the rest of the story. So you grew up in Queens. And you started cutting records. I saw, now this may be wrong, one of the first records you cut was the single of The Streak for, you know that hit record, The Streak?
God, I have no
I'm sure
memory.
You have no memory of it.
I always say Kung Fu Fighting was one of the biggest, you know, that was an early one that came through. So, Janis Ian at 17, and then the first gold record I had was Eric Carmen All by Myself.
No, those are all of those are great records.
He just passed away.
So my question is, when you cut a record, I don't know, Bruce Springsteen, Born to Run or whatever, and then they want to have singles cut, are you cutting the singles yourself? You are. So if we any album you cut you probably cut the singles as well.
Absolutely. In that era, they would never use somebody else for a single. If somebody was called in to mix a single, a separate mix, and they had a different engineer that they used, but that would be very rare in those years. Usually the album was done, They would pick a single either during a recording or after the thing was recorded, and then you know we cut this. Maybe sometimes depending on the release, we cut the single first, but usually we do reference acetates, which the acetate is the first thing that somebody gets. In other words, it's not pressed in a pressing plant; it's actually cut on the cutting lathe, the same way that you cut the master on the cutting lathe, except the master gets electroplated and made into a record, but the acetate is a little bit different material, and it could be played up to 10 times. You start getting a little degradation.
So you make one of these and you would write down all the settings?
Because
now you have to go give it to them and they have to listen to it and get back to you.
Yes, you'd have a cutting, we would call a cutting card. The cutting card would have all the settings. And this was kind of the beginning of the really creative part of disc cutting. Because different guys would start doing, well, one of the guys, Bob Ludwig, was one of these guys that would do internal changes on a song while you were cutting.
So the bridge, I'm going to have more compression.
Yeah, occasionally we would have to do that for, I just want to tell everybody, this job was a bitch. One of the hardest jobs. I still have nightmares about it. Like 20 years after, I hadn't really done it since 1992, and I still occasionally wake up after a dream of a nightmare dream. It was so difficult to maintain your focus and concentration six or eight times. Like if you were going to do a record, for example, Paul Simon, Graceland, we did what we call parts. We did lacquers that got sent all over the world. I probably had to listen to that album 50 times. So you're sitting there, and you have to keep your eye on everything in the room, and you're just sitting there waiting for the next song so you can make a change in the level or a change in something. So if you screwed it up, it'll start from scratch.
But let me just clarify.
Sure.
You would cut a lacquer, which they would make a stamper out of,
yes,
and you'd have to make several of them. So there could be slight differences. There are slight differences in, you know, I mean, if you move that dial a millimeter differently, that's going to sound different in one country than the next.
And depending on your producer or your engineer, whoever was going to listen to the vinyl, if he heard something that didn't sound right, you're going to hear about it. And sometimes it would be too late. Sometimes the record had been released already.
Hmm.
I've said this a couple of times, and the people always think it's weird, but because we used to do parts for Canada, if I did one that had a little mistake, I wouldn't do it like an egregious mistake, but a little mistake would go to Canada because my producer would never hear that particular one. But in those years, there were pressing plants in New York, in Indiana, and in L.A., and a couple of other locations. There's one down south. You had to know, like, the territory that your producer was going to be getting a record from if you screwed it up.
But
I have to say, though, in my own defense, it would only be something really, really minor that nobody would hear.
So,
you know?
Bruce Springsteen, Born to Run, pretty huge record in a lot of ways, right? Cover of Newsweek. It just kind of was a little bit of a turning point. But for you, is it just another day at the office?
No. No, that was we could actually do a whole show. And it's funny because I'm doing it's a 45-minute lecture thing down in South Jersey. Somebody's doing a symposium on Born to Run, and she asked me if I would just speak about my experience with it. I have a lot of memories and a lot of backdrop to Born to Run. It meant a lot to me to be on that record. It was recorded in the studio that I worked in, Record Plant, and during the course of the recording and the mixing, I got to hear the songs before the album was mastered. In other words, I would hear a mix. Jimmy Iovine was mixing it. He was a good friend of mine at that point. He was, as he will admit, and I think I've heard him admit, he was very insecure at that point. He needed positive feedback.
He got over it.
Yeah, he definitely got over it. He's done pretty well for himself. It is pretty incredible to know somebody that used to have like an eggplant parmesan sandwich with his mom and dad, and now he's a billionaire. But anyway, the thing with Bruce is that I loved the first two albums, and when I heard, I passed the studio where the song Born to Run was cut before the album. The song Born to Run, they came into the studio almost right after I had seen them at Avery Fisher Hall. I had seen the gig that the E Street Band did after the first two albums, and I was completely blown away. And I will say it on the air, absolutely, that the first time Jimmy Iovine ever heard of Bruce Springsteen was out of my mouth, because I told him that we saw them on Friday night at Avery Fisher, and he said, I never heard of him. Never heard of them. Once Jimmy got the smell in his nose about how good they were, Jimmy made sure he worked on the records, and he did a great job. I mean, so that mastering, the whole project was a different, very personal. It was very personal to me because I loved the band. It was very personal to me because I was involved in some of the balances or having a reaction to some of the balances of what they were doing. And also, I had a physical experience of listening to the song Jungle Land for the first time, and actually, I had chill stuff.
You have potty mouth.
this stuff is unbelievable. Everybody in the music business has potty mouth, by the way. But this record is really unbelievable. And then all the publicity started to come out about the history of, you know, the future of rock and roll, the John Landau stuff, the gig at the Bottom Line, you know, all that stuff, which I was on vacation and couldn't go to, which was really hurtful. But the thing about it, about that, in the long run, which shows you maybe an insight into how personal the job could be to certain people, is that after Born to Run, when they started working on the next project, I think the next project was The River. I'm not 100% sure. Whatever the next project was,
sounds right.
There was a change in his production team at that point. They started with a new producer, and that new producer had an engineer, one of the greats, Bob Ludwig, and they used Bob for every record since. So I only worked on one project, and it was Born to Run, and I never got a chance to do it for CD. I never got a chance to, you know, I just never got a chance to work with them again.
Just real quickly, sure. I was looking at some Bruce Springsteen compilations, and it does sometimes say Born to Run mastered by Greg Kalby.
Yeah.
So are they, where are they getting that audio from?
They're probably not getting that audio from anything I did, because this is way before the digital era, and unless they had a copy, if it was some type of a compilation, they would have only had a tape copy of a tape. It would be a tape copy of a tape copy that I made.
So who knows?
So you never know.
Weird that there are records that you are the original master of that then had to come out on CD a decade later. Sometimes you still get credit on the CD that maybe you didn't work on. It's very, because maybe they didn't, especially when they were rushing CDs out in the early days, they really were not really being mastered particularly with a lot of care, I think.
Yeah.
And then your name is on something that maybe sounds bad. I don't know.
I don't think anybody could actually understand how amateurish record labels are when it comes to credits and production and keeping track of tapes. So many tapes have been lost through carelessness. A lot, you know, I mean, who knew that 50 years later we'd be talking about Born to Run? Who knew that, you know, everybody now is having like a 32nd anniversary of the release of an album, a 17 and a half anniversary. And whoever's involved in these things, they license the stuff. I
want to point out that Greg Kalby is spelled wrong on the Keith Richards album, which is kind of, maybe Keith wrote it down, and that's what I'm thinking. I'm curious about tools. The number of tools the day you mastered Born to Run, right, is limited to outboard gear, to these things that fit in a rack, these machines that had tubes in them and transistors in them and optical sensors or whatever.
Right.
And there's only so many that fit in that room, and, you know, your choices were sort of limited, which might have some upside and some downside to it. And then as the years went on, the tools more and more, to the point where you start using a computer, and I'm curious what year that was, and then there's now software to help you master. And I know that up until recently, you're still using lots of hardware, lots of software, and there's literally an unlimited amount of choices of tools now. Is that helpful? Is that a pain in some ways? What's the upside and the downside?
Okay, so what you said was true. The tools that we had were extremely rudimentary and also very coarse compared to what we have in this era, or what was developed actually through the from the late 80s into the 90s. But in the 70s, there was no special gear. You basically had your setup. You had your rack. In your rack was an equalizer that had increments of 2 dB, which is a lot of EQ. Now we do 1/10 of a dB in digital. We do 1/10 of a 2 dB. If something needed, if John Lennon, one of his mixes needed some vocal, I would add 2 dB at 1.4. I would very rarely. But the thing is that you weren't required to have that much creative input at that point. You know, the engineers were pretty professional. Pretty much, you know, it's just a different business. Professional studio, professional engineers. If you had a good cutter, the cutter head itself had a sound. Okay, the actual the cutter head, which is they cost about $8,000 back then, like 50 years ago. I mean, they had to be tuned to a certain level of finesse, and that was the sound. What you had was the sound of your tape machine, the sound of your amplification going to the cutter amp itself, and the acetate, whatever the acetate.
So it's interesting. So as you moved into the box for mastering, recording also moved into the box. So they met each other at that point. You needed to...
Well, you know, everything happened really slowly because the early digital, there wasn't that many tools. We had... Neve created this digital console, which if somebody worked in digital and they wanted to keep it digital, then you would have basically only one equalizer and one compressor in this digital console. At the point when Sterling bought them, they were worth $125,000. When we bought Sterling in 1997, and this console was completely replaced by PCs, that was worth nothing. It was basically thrown out for garbage. It had no use anymore.
Isn't that fun?
And it was a very difficult little piece of equipment. So there was, you know, there's just been such an evolution, a slow evolution. But the point that we're at now is different engineers, some of them like me, enjoy their analog equipment and have a rack full of this stuff. And a lot of stuff is available. Then there's endless amounts of digital plugins, processing plugins, to do compression, equalization, all kinds of center channel stuff, expanding the width. I mean, there's all kinds of imaging things that you can do now. And some of the younger engineers have taken to that and do a fantastic job.
Are there guys at Sterling who only work in digital realm? Tons.
I am not permitted to answer that.
Who knows?
Particular
the
question.
Magical formula.
Yes.
So you ended up... the folks at Sterling Sound, which was just a mastering house, end
yes.
up poaching you. Yeah, your reputation at the record plant for mastering all these amazing records in
yeah,
your
well,
first
I had
few
three hot
years.
I had three hot records at the same time, which Born Throne was one of them. Young Raz, Americans, David Bowie, mm-hmm. Young Americans, and the Eric Carmen. Those three, and then I had a client named Jimmy Einer. Unfortunately, his name is probably not as famous as Jimmy Iovine, because at that time he was famous, and he was a very active producer, and he sent me a lot of work. So I had, in other words, I had an income stream, and I had the imprimatur from George Marino, who was originally at Record Plant, and Bob Ludwig left Sterling Sound, and I needed an engineer, and they wanted to get somebody out of New York and get somebody young or whatever, and there I was. So I went over to Sterling, and I just started to work on a different, you know, it was kind of a whole different environment. It was a transition that came right around the same time as all the downtown scene started. And, you know, one of the early, in the first year, I did the first Ramones album. So
those guys, I don't get the feeling that they're the kind of guys who attend a session.
That's what I said when they walked in the door.
They did.
I said, who the hell are these guys? I mean, I couldn't believe it. I mean, Tommy Erdely was definitely there. I think it was Joey and Tommy. And, I just looked at them, and you know, with the torn jeans and everything. And they were from, you know, I'm from Queens, Bayside Queens. They were from Forest Hills, so you know, they sounded like New Yorkers and everything. And then when I put the stuff on, it was crazy what it sounded like. But they really wanted to listen loud,
especially that first album with the bass on one side, the guitar.
Oh yeah, it was kind of like almost like a nightmare to listen to try to figure out what's going on here. Who are they? What am I supposed to do with this? So they really wanted to listen loud. And then as I started listening, it everything got really muffled. And I thought the next song was like muffled. Anyway, what happened was they blew up my speakers. My speakers were electrostatic speakers, which I had just started working on. I didn't realize they had a fuse on them. So they blew the fuses on both of the speakers. So I was in a panic because I didn't know what to do. And they were so excited that they blew the speakers. They actually got on the phone. You know, this is before cell phones. They got on the studio phone and they started calling their friends. Oh, we blew the speakers up at Sterling. You know, it was a great memory. Uh-huh. But that, you know, that was kind of the beginning of. Then I had another client named Richard Goddard, who is still in the music business. A very talented guy. Came from the earlier 1950s era, and he. You know, he brought me Blondie and
Robert Gordon, Marshall Crenshaw.
A couple of Robert Gordons, Marshall Crenshaw. Yeah, Richard was a good client for a long time. Was really good to me. Very grateful to him. But I got in that loop of being like, okay, this is the guy who's doing the that type of thing. You know, the
Talking Heads, a lot of New York Tom Club.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, the whole scene, I was gravitating. A lot of stuff
television.
That we would not have remembered. There were so many other ones that have not stood the test of time. So I kind of
It is interesting to me, though, to get, like, you're talking about listening at full volume. Like, your ears are your tool, your number one tool in some ways. And do you have to worry about that? And when you know, I know, especially in later days, like, you might have a day where you are working on Tony Bennett and Lady Gaga,
yeah.
and then a country record, and
yeah.
then a punk rock record.
Yeah.
Do you have to, like, go for a walk in between those or do something?
I don't have to go for a walk, but I try not to back up something that's as nuanced as a Tony Bennett with after I did have done a really super bright record.
So you would do those in the order of least...
Yes. No, I'd be very careful. But and this is kind of... It's not that technical. I think everybody would understand this, but I have a certain volume level. Literally, there's a notch on my volume control, and I always listen at that level.
Hmm.
I listen to everything at that level, and I can't judge the relationship with bass, mid-range, and treble without being at my level. The thing is, and I was thinking about this, I wanted to just mention anybody who listens to this that's a technical person in the recording area. Pick a level, but make it as low a level as you can and still be effective and enjoy what you're doing. Don't listen loud for prolonged periods of time. I have tremendous tinnitus now. I have, everybody my age has high-end hearing loss. That comes with the territory. But the tinnitus is a drag. And the combination of one tip that I give everybody, the other one is take care of your body, your inner core. I have back issues. All engineers, every engineer I talk to that I've told I have back issues, they have back issues too. I never met one that says, oh, my back feels great. Doesn't happen. Sitting is not the way the human body was designed. And when you get paid for sitting, hour after hour, day after day, year after
That's
year.
That's funny. You don't think of that as a sound engineer problem. excuse me.
Major problem.
I want to remind folks that Greg Calbee is our guest, and this is WFMU East Orange, WMFU Mount Hope in New York City and Rockland County at 91.9 FM and online over at WFMU.org. You know, you don't have a website. You need a website, Greg Calbee, because I want to say, hey, folks can go here. I guess they can go to Sterling Sound.
Sterling Sound has a great website, and actually we're redesigning it right now, but that has all the links for my discography and everything.
You're not retiring, but you are pulling back. I don't know what the right words are exactly. You're slowing down?
I decided to do for the first time since age 23 is to take the summer off. I just last summer.
Zero mastering this summer.
No, zero. And I got a couple of calls from people already, and it's like, I'm not going in. I mean, I just felt like I needed to feel what it felt like not to do this every day for a while. So I June, July, August, and September, I'm going to be sitting out. And then I'm going to make a decision as to how that felt in October, and I'll either be available, but I will not take any new – I won't be taking any new
I
people.
Get the feeling you're not missing it so much.
After about 7 weeks, I'm not missing it at all.
Zero.
And I'm finding myself really, like, in a different – like, musically trying to, like, really – really getting an idea of – what I need emotionally from the music. It is interesting. Like less background music and more like looking for inspiration kind of stuff, you know?
Yeah, well, it's not a job anymore. Maybe.
Yeah.
I really was going back and forth on whether or not I wanted to list folks that you've worked with, because as you said, 8,000 projects. So I list 20. What does that mean? Or, you know, we've talked about some, but I did want to, just in case folks are listening who, because I remember being in high school and being a little bit of a, you know, I was always into music, and I was always reading every word on an LP,
yeah,
you know, and, oh, mastered by Greg Cobain. Who is that guy? You know, but your name was in a lot of records I have. So Lou Reed, Harry Nilsson, Three Dog Night, Kansas, Raspberries, Eric Carmen, John Lennon, Bob Dylan, Natalie Cole, Springsteen, Edgar Winter, Dictators, Blue Oyster Cult, Bowie, Blondie, Bay City Rollers, Foghat, Supertramp, a huge record, right? 38 Special, Hall & Oates, Iggy Pop, Richard Hell, Miko, that Star Wars record. That was you. Huge record, though, right? Golden Earring, Patti Smith, The Jam, Tom Petty, Ian Dury, Dire Straits, Sugar Hill Gang, Go-Go's, Luther Vandross, Todd Rundgren, B-52's, Tom Club, R.E.M., Susan Vega, Aretha Franklin, Deep Purple, Bon Jovi, Paul Simon, Eric Clapton, Anthrax, Living Color, Lenny Kravitz, Paul McCartney, Smithereens, Amy Mann, Strokes, Kings of Leon, My Morning Jacket, Interpol, Emmylou Harris, Hold Steady Spoon, John Mayer, Nora Jones, Yola Tango, Bon Iver, I never know how to say that name, Drive-By Truckers, Alabama, Shakes, Fall Out Boy, Yeah Yeah Yeahs, National St. Vincent, Dinosaur Jr. So records that still, you know, Casey Musgraves, I think you won a thing for that, Arcade Fire. You've never stopped working, and those are all names people know, right? People have heard those records every day of their life. What percentage of sessions, like of those ones I just read, is somebody in the room with you, an attended session? The client is there. Was that a normal thing for the client to be in the room for mastering?
It was a normal thing for the client to be in the room. You know,
and it's the producer or it's the artist or both?
It could be anybody. It could be the manager. It could be the band, the whole band. If it was a Japanese album, the band would come in, the whole band and the manager and the publicist.
They fly from Japan.
Yeah, they'd fly in the old days when the Japanese economy was smoking, and when there was a big, it really felt like we did a better job of anything that they could do there. That we would get 8 or 10 people in there, and it was unbelievable. But I really liked working with people, and I still always encourage people, because a lot of mastering guys, even in my own shop, they don't want anybody around them. They really don't. I mean,
you love it.
It's the only thing in the job that kept me going.
Do you think that's part of your success, is that you are sort of a people person? People like you. I mean, your reputation is a really open, nice guy.
I do think so. Because I know technically what my limitations are, and I know that there are some mastering guys who are much more curious about technical things that come into our business than I am. I'm curious, but kind of like not as curious about the people that come in. And I want to do a great job, but it's what motivates me. I mean, the pandemic was like 2 years of working by myself. I mean, that was the worst. I mean, I didn't have any, we weren't allowed to have anybody in the studio. We weren't even allowed to have the other engineers that I work with come in the room. We just used to go in our room and go home. And this is not what I signed up for.
Do artists come in there with unrealistic expectations, thinking you've got magic in those boxes?
Again, there's just so many answers to every question, and there are artists who have had a problem with digesting what they've done, and they need you to do something to make them either feel better or get their ears better. And I always try to show people exactly what I'm doing, not verbally, but actually show them, this is what you brought me, and this is what it sounds like now. You know, sometimes I could work on a song for half an hour, and this is what you brought me, and this is what it sounds like now. And I would say 10% of the time, 15% of the time, somebody will go like, I like it better what I brought you.
Oh.
Well, yeah. That's called the swing and the miss.
They're also used to it, though.
Yeah,
you know?
and they're used to it. And then I would have, well, what is it that you like about it?
Why'd you come here? Yeah.
Now, if you weren't here, I wouldn't know that, and I would send it to you, and then a week later, you would call your friend up and say, well, I don't know. I don't really like what he did, blah, blah.
So in a case like that, do you find something that he does or she does?
Oh, yeah.
Does
no,
like
that's the whole job. That's what I like about the job.
So they go, okay, we improved it, and everyone's happy.
It gets to be kind of like a duel. And then it's a translation of like, okay, this guy has different tastes than I have. I have to make him happy. So let me start to understand what he's looking for, and I'll dig and I'll dig and I'll dig. And to me, that's the fun part of the job. But it's not the norm. It's not the norm now. Because
you worked on, we said earlier, Dylan. You worked on Beatles. I know you've worked on some Stones and Stones related records. Bowie, right? Some huge records. You brought in this CDR that says Sgt. Pepper Master on it. What is this?
Okay, so in 1997.
And let me preface by saying you did master. Is it the Beatles mono box set? Is that what the one you?
It was a re-release of the American versions of the albums. But the American versions of the Beatles albums had different sequences, different content in early in the career, right. Up until the White Album. I think there was different. They cut the albums up in different.
They would
different
have 10
sequences.
Songs, but the British ones had 14 songs. So they
right,
would make,
and then the other 14 songs were put in another album.
Classic.
That they would kind of. So it was all many things have been written about that. But what they wanted to do, they wanted to release the American albums, and I had a chance to work on digital files that were used for the British albums and kind of tweak them for the American market, right? So, in other words, I got a chance to EQ the Beatle albums. Yay, that was great. And the thing that I noticed for the most part from the English stuff that came over was that the bass was very, it wasn't so much thin. You could hear it, but it didn't have any balls. I mean, it just needed to be enhanced. So I ran, you know, a lot of those albums, I ran through some analog stuff, and I was able to get a good bounce on it. And although I was instructed not to change anything.
And these were for CD release?
Yes, for CD release. And
not to change anything, what?
Well, I figured, like, I can change something. Maybe they won't hear it if they don't have a good ear, but... After it came out, a couple of months after it came out, it was reviewed in an English magazine, and they said, this is the best bass sound on any of the Beatles releases as of now. And that, so I did my job. So that was like, I had to do a little undercut, you know, like, kind of like, that was a little political decision I needed to make. But I couldn't resist.
So what is this CD right here?
So this was, Jeff Emmerich had become a client of mine over the years. He had done an Art Garfunkel record. He was working in L.A. Jeff was the Beatles engineer who eventually moved to Los Angeles. His mom still lived in England. He still spent a lot of time in England. But he was a very, very sweet guy, and he was very, very nice to me. And he brought me a couple of projects. There was an Amy Grant record that he did. I think that was the one with Garfunkel. Nellie Mackay was another act that he would bring to me, and Jeff was just a lovely guy, and he was whatever I did was fine. I mean, if something needed EQ, it was like, just do it, you know, whatever you think, you know. So he brought me this thing, and they were going to release a I guess at that point, what would that be, a 30th anniversary? 1997 would be the 30th anniversary of the release of Sgt. Pepper. So he brought me Sgt. Pepper. He brought me the tape of Sgt. Pepper, and it was very interesting because he didn't have the tape. A guy from Apple from England came in, and he had a briefcase with a lock on it, and he did not leave the room for a minute. He watched, right? So before the session, the night before the session, I had a Hitchcock-style dream, and it was that I put the tape on the machine, and I was rewinding it, and it flew off the machine, and it went over a railing. I was on, like, a balcony, and it went over the railing, and it spun. Like, it was, like, a really totally scary.
This is the tape that they mixed down in 1967.
Yes.
They brought it on an airplane.
It was the original master.
And it's almost weird that they would let that out of the country. I don't know. I mean, I guess that's what you need to use.
Well, that's why they paid a guy to come over with a separate airfare. And when we broke for lunch, he took the tape off the machine. He put the tape in his attaché case. And he disappeared and he came back. We had to put it back on the machine again.
And so was this released here?
Well, what happened, first of all, the transfer was very, very neutral. The tape sounded incredibly good. I had a really good converter to make it digital. We had a Pultec, and I put a little bit, which is a very sweet-sounding analog equalization. I put a little bit of the highs on it, and basically we ran it, and
this is the straight transfer.
It was
here.
Basically a straight transfer.
Let's hear from it. What track do you want to hear on this? Little Help from My Friends.
No, not that one.
Getting Better, Fixing a Hole.
Oh, Getting Better would be, I think, a good one.
All right. I think we can hear that. Let's see. Make sure I've got the right thing here. All right, let's hear this Greg Calvi.
It was also never released because Linda died right after that, and they decided not to do this because Paul was, you know, just didn't want to promote anything. He was so it never could. This has no one's ever heard this except friends of mine.
All right, and now you folks.
And everybody.
The Beatles, you may have heard of them. Mastered by Greg Calvi. Let me ask you about, you know, I'm always interested in nobody that I interview much wants to talk about sex and drugs. They do want to talk about rock and roll because they're, but you, without naming names, do people come into your room inebriated, high, etc.? You've worked with Aerosmith, right?
No, Aerosmith.
I'm joking, of course, lawyers.
Yeah,
you know.
I know. No, But I'll tell the story because he's just such a remarkable individual at 82 or 83 years old. Mick Jagger.
Sure.
But this is the one time I remember anything even remotely like this. But so he did his first solo album. It was called Primitive Cool, and my friend Ed Stasium mixed that with him. Recorded and mixed it.
Okay.
And he came in for the mastering. Mick is coming in for the mastering. I said, oh, this is going to be interesting, you know, this whatever. So he rolled in. We started talking. For some reason, he kept calling me Red. He called me Red the whole session, you know, and he never got the full name, but that was okay, right? So we started working, and all of a sudden, I'm just trying to see whether I have to edit this conversation, but I don't think so at this point. It's so many years ago. So his assistant comes in, Jane, and she comes in and she goes to the coffee table, and she takes out this big rock of cocaine, and she starts chopping it up, chop 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 chop. And I'm working, listening to the music. I'm going like, what? This is what? So. She puts out about 12 lines across the table, and she's just very, like, almost like it was like you would just give somebody their morning mail, you know, come in with the mail, whatever. And she just leaves, and that thing is sitting there all day. And every once in a while, you know, the artist is walking over and, you know, partaking. And then somehow, incredibly, at one point in the afternoon, after the everything's finished off the table, same person comes in. And does another round and chop, 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 chop.
Wow.
Yeah. So that, and there was no indication from him. I mean, he was very nice, very good to work with. We had a good, you know, we had a really good session. And he didn't steal my jacket, which is something that he did. Apparently, he stole somebody's, one of the assistants' jackets in the studio that he was working in. So. You know, see, this is the beauty of maybe not having to work anymore because I can, you know, I have way more
time to write your book, Greg. Yeah, absolutely.
That's all I need. No, there will be no book, everybody.
But,
there will be no
book. I mean, that wasn't a common, really, because it's so funny because I'm imagining everyone in the 80s was taking drugs all day long.
Yeah, well, they would, you know, in the studio, see, it was, first of all, mastering
the sun was up, maybe?
Well, it was serious business at that point, you know what I mean? I think everybody knew that. It wasn't like, if you're in a studio, first of all, the boredom of making records in those years, when the budgets were so massive, people didn't, you know, people could basically screw around all day long. And there was a lot of boredom involved, so people would just, you know, smoke a joint or whatever and do blow. I mean, you know, every once in a while, somebody would come in and want to smoke a joint. But I wasn't around that's the sex and drugs part of rock and roll. As a matter of fact, I missed a lot of the fun. Everybody said, "Oh, you were in the '70s. You probably had a great time." No, I had to be at work every morning at 10 o'clock.
In a room with no windows. Yeah, yeah.
I had an okay time. I mean, I was.
You had a lot of free tickets, I assume, to great shows.
Yeah, I had a great. My ex-wife used to work at Arista, and she became friends with these really lovely people, Melanie and Ed Rogers, who still really good friends. And they used to get into all the shows and get us into all the shows. So, you know, in that period when I used to love to go out and my ears could take it, I would go, and I remember being online for at the Ritz to see the Police, like 8 o'clock on a Sunday morning. When I really used to go out. I really cared about the music and the shows.
I've been to see shows with you. You love music today.
No, I do.
But now you freak out sometimes.
Now, like somebody 2 years ago, you want to see McCartney? I go like, it's going to be so much traffic, and I don't know, it's going to be too loud. I mean, that's not But, to everything there's a time and a season, right?
Do you think that you have, that you were born with better ears or ears that make doing your job the right job for you? Or is it something that you have trained yourself to do? Or is it a combination of both?
Well, I think... that's better ears would be... That would be part of the job. Better meaning more aware of the nuances, certain types of nuances, like the overtones, like the
I've been in a mastering room with you, and you reach and you move a knob an eighth of an inch, and you go, "How about that?" Right? And I'm like, I don't hear anything. I really don't hear a difference, right?
Yeah.
But you're like, "Oh my God, I can't believe how much better it is now," you know? So is that something that you were born with or something that you've learned to isolate?
You know, I think it was like a kind of a slow process of learning, but I think that from childhood, and I say childhood, I mean, I distinctly remember lying on the beach with a transistor radio right on my ear and listening to like Motown songs and being so enthralled with the sound of it on the beach, with that sound on the beach,
yeah.
You know, I met 20 years ago. I got involved with this organization, and there was a neuroscientist, I think, and he thought it was very, very unusual that I could remember sound, that I could remember how something sounds, not the content, not that even like a guitar lick or a drum fill or something, but that I could remember the sonics. They thought he thought that was a very unusual and interesting thing that he wanted to study. And in answer to your question, maybe there is something about the way I hear, but there would be no way for me to understand what you would hear. I mean, I could, like with my son, for example, I always wondered whether he wanted to do what I do, and he was really into music as a teenager. But when I bring him into the studio, he wouldn't really hear the nuances he kind of was bored with it a little bit. You know, it's like, "Dad, what's the same?" I said, "No, it's not the same. Listen closely." And he was like, "I don't know. I don't get it." He just didn't hear it. But there are people, and the one that I always remember is like Mike Brecker. Mike Brecker, one of the absolutely top saxophone players of the 20th century, but we would do things in the studio to put high end on stuff and everything like that, and he would just shrug his shoulders. He wouldn't hear it, and yet in his intonation, he would probably hear every little tiny thing that was off pitch, like a hair. He would hear that, but he wouldn't hear the sonic thing. You know what I mean? It's just as opposed to visual, it's really hard for me to understand what you hear.
But we should point out that it doesn't matter, right? Like I bring up my wife on the radio show a lot because she's a person who loves music, enjoys music, couldn't care less. Mm-hmm. Like, "Oh, the bass sound is good? I don't know. Mm-hmm. I just like that song," right? Mm-hmm. It sounds good. Like, you know, whatever. And that's how most people experience music, right?
Yeah.
They're not at all thinking about, if they're hearing one thing, they're not hearing, "Oh, the bass player is, you know," whatever, "the bass player's cousin." You know, it's like, but guys like you and me are too deep in the woods. But, you know, as long as you're churning out something that people are listening to on the beach, then it works.
Yeah, the other thing that I think has helped me is that I think because of the amount of listening that I've done as a fan, I'm not a musician, but I've played music, you know, it's like, it's really, really all a part of me. And I think that I listen like a mixer listens. Like, if a song comes in and the chorus is not loud enough, there's not enough excitement, that's really a mix job. That's not a lot of mastering guys might go there. They might not. I mean, I don't really know. But I listen like a mixer would listen. And if there's a lack of excitement somewhere, I can hear it right away. And then I got to try to figure out, is that excitement something I can do by enhancing the tone of something? Or is it something just inherent in the decision that they made? Or Do they know it's not exciting? I mean, I've called people up and say, like, you have to remix.
You need a tambourine, my friend.
Yeah, you need to juice it up here at some point,
so,
you know?
So let me ask you, if you could give one paragraph of advice to folks who are mixing a record that they're going to hand to the mastering guy, what are folks doing wrong, or what could they improve?
Assuming that they recorded and mixed, because it's two different.
The whole package. Yeah. What's not happening in either stage that you're seeing consistently these days?
Okay. Distortion is one thing. Distortion is something which I think that the younger generation has heard things distorted so much that they're not sensitive to distortion. And
You mean they're not hearing it, or they're using it as an effect?
No, they're not hearing it as anything negative. They're hearing it as part of an effect, that it's kind of
and they're overdoing it.
You could have it on. There was a record that I worked on a couple of years ago with a singer named Angel Olsen, who's really very talented, and it was a real swing and a miss for me, because they kept hearing distortion from what I was giving them, and I heard nothing but distortion from what they gave me. Mm. It was distorted when you sent it, and the guy would say, "No, it's more distorted now," and it was so distorted in my ear that I just had to throw my hands up and say, I ran it past three other engineers at our studio. They all heard what I heard, but this other person was hearing something that I couldn't hear, and the whole thing kind of fell apart.
I was listening to this Chuck Berry recording recently, and his vocals are distorted in such a good way.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
He's singing, and you can just see that needle going boom,
yeah.
But it sounds so great, and there's no modern equivalent to doing that. I think you can. There's a lot of plugins that add what is supposed to be a analog pleasant overdrive or saturation.
Yeah,
I guess,
yeah.
Is what they're. I mean, there's a whole million plugins that do this.
Yeah.
But yeah, I agree. It's unpleasant.
Distortions. But the other thing of it that I would say is that I think a lot of people don't spend enough time with their drum samples to try to get something that really has something a sound that's a little bit more interesting. And, you know, especially if something's very snare drum forward and really rhythmically needs the snare drum. If the snare, there's so many creative ways to make drums sound better in the box. Listen, if you record it and the recording's done already, you can't go back in. But I think paying attention to getting something vibrant and interesting from the drum kit is really, really important. And if you're using drum samples, there are endless amounts of samples, but I think that it's so time consuming. But I would say that would be one big piece of advice to somebody for me, would be like, pay much more attention, more than you maybe have the capacity for, to create something in the drums that's special, because it's really important.
So without that, no matter what you put on top
it's just only it's only yeah it's yeah and the And the and, you know the other thing, I mean, there's really every, I mean, guitars, I think in some ways are a little bit easier because there's just so much character in a guitar and everything. But you know, bass is another thing. Like if the bass sound is really, really either ugly, just ugly sound, you know, each of the individual instruments require a tremendous amount of time, and time is money, or time is time. But whatever it is, in the 70s, in the 60s, 70s, and 80s, people had way, way, way more time and money to make a record than they do now. There's a price that we're paying for the free music that we get, and that the price is a less quality product.
Right. The upside is anyone can make a record in their house, and the downside is anyone can
make a record
in their house. So we're getting some records we never would have heard,
yep.
But we're also getting records we don't need to hear. Yeah.
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 Yeah. But you're getting a lot of work by this. I guess at a certain point in your life, your name was on so many amazing records, and it's so many amazing sounding records, that there were just people all over the world who were like, "Well, I want to work with this guy, right?" Because for no other reason besides he did all these other records. And you're one of the few businesses where pretty much anybody can call up Sterling Sound and say, "I want to get on this guy's calendar," right? Mm-hmm. It's not like you can say to Steven Spielberg, "Hey, direct my bar mitzvah movie or whatever," right? But you know, "Hey, Picasso, paint my picture." But yeah, people can go to you and say, "I'm going to buy 4 hours of Greg's day,"
yeah.
And so you have to do it. And in some ways, it's great, right? It meant your dance calendar has been full for the past 15 years. I mean, at a certain point, but it also may be why you're a little bit like, oh, okay, enough.
Yeah, well, and you know, I mean, at one point, it's, you know, every time somebody in our world, you know, when Jeff Beck died and he was 79 years old, that freaked me out. It was like he was a vibrant, working, top-level guy, and all of a sudden it was lights out. And then, you know, it's a nice summer day, and you're sitting in the room listening to a couple of songs that you don't want to listen to, and you go like, okay, man, you know, is this really so much fun how you want to spend your time? So,
and you got kids, and you got...
Yeah,
you know.
And it got a lot, you know, there's just a lot, and there's a lot of things that I don't even know that I haven't done yet. I don't even know what they are, but that's kind of what I'm looking forward to.
Are you taking classical guitar? What were you telling me?
Yeah, well, I don't know, about 5 or 6 years
ago. You told me
you're
taking a writing class also?
Well, I took classical guitar for about 2 years. My teacher, Andy Favell, was a great teacher. He moved down south to North Carolina, to Asheville. And then I took bass lessons, as you've unfortunately had to hear the results of when we jammed one day. But it took bass lessons for a while with Paul Byrne in Montclair, which was also really great. And I started a writing class that I've taken altogether. It was about a year and a half, I guess. And to try to see, because I'm just one of those people that have a million ideas of what I want to write. And as soon as I hit the page and I read it back, it just doesn't have the life that I want it to have. I can't get what's in my head onto, you know.
As you work less, I don't get any indication that you're going to be bored.
Oh, I could be bored.
Really?
Yeah, I could be. Well, and when I'm bored, like my therapist always says, like boredom is a lack of attention. It's like when you're not paying attention. And I think that helps me, because it's like if you feel bored, you got to like, well, what you got to really drill down into the boredom, and then I can get out of it. I mean, I don't get bored day to day, but you know, for so many years I've been on a schedule, and the schedule is you come in the morning. You have 8 hours worth of work assigned. If you don't do the 8 hours, you got to finish what you didn't and then move it to tomorrow. And it's been pretty much until about a year and a half or 2 years ago, I was always jammed. And then in the last couple of years, I've been like medium jammed enough and working 4 days a week. But the thing is now is that even like on a day where I would normally like I would be in traffic and I would always be like in a hurry to get home or to get to work. And now I'm in traffic. I go like, What else can I listen to? Who else can I call? I mean, it just changed. My whole concept of time is starting to like morph, and I'm really enjoying it. It's like an experiment. Like I'm the subject of the experiment.
Just abstractly, what's the most work you ever did on a single song or a single record, and what's the least work you ever did on a single song?
That's the most work would be anything that I worked with Jim Steinman, Meatloaf, Bonnie Tyler. Yeah, that's the most you keep, because Jim was crazy. I mean, he had massive budgets, and he would do things like you would work on a song, and he would say, "Can you speed it up like half of 1%, which is almost inaudible?" And then he would take that and he'd go home. And he would come in the next week, and he would have the same song again, do the same thing to it. He says, "Can you try speeding it up like 0.75%? Like this is like cutting hairs, like super." But he would do that with almost everything, and then he would end up remixing everything, and it would be months and months and months of going. And everybody who worked with him knew exactly what. I mean, this is a guy who, when he went to a restaurant, he would order everything that they had, every entree. He would order. So he didn't know what he couldn't make up his mind. Mm. He was really nuts. He was the sweetest guy. He had that sweetheart. Always treated me well. Total respectful. But that was when it comes to like the longest part. Bonnie Tyler, "Total Eclipse of the Heart." That might have been the most that I've ever worked on.
Huge hit, right?
Yeah.
What are you gonna do?
Yeah.
At a certain point, do you lose your like? You know, next I'm not answering the phone this next time this guy calls, because even though it pays, you know, every time, right? It's just it's just not how you want to spend your day.
The only guy that I definitely didn't want to work with was a guy who was he was a close talker, and he had like the worst breath, and it was funny. He was
a famous person.
It is not fair for me. He wasn't famous. He had a band that was like not famous, but he had a deal. He had a couple of records.
Okay.
But the guy was like right in my face, and it was just torturous. So,
And then I guess the other side of the coin is there are records that you put up the tape and you went, this is perfect, I'll just do a little limiting or whatever. And
yeah, like the one that I got a Grammy for with Tony Bennett and Lady Gaga. Dave Bennett, Tony Bennett's son, great engineer, recorded it, mixed it. It was fantastic. It took all of maybe 4 hours to do the whole job by myself. He didn't come in. We sent it out. He was happy. She was happy. Everybody was happy. Done. Ended up getting a Grammy for it. Unbelievable. And I called him up to thank him, and I said, Dave, this is ridiculous. I mean, I shouldn't do it. I mean, I worked. And he said something which I referred to earlier in this interview, which was that we send it to you because we know that you won't ruin it. These guys that are around, they have to. And it was like, well, that's true, because I respect him. See, because I worked in the studio, I respect what goes into the job. I think that's what some of the people who come into this strictly from out of audio school or out of college program or whatever, and they, oh, I love mastering. Well, if you love mastering, you should kind of get around recording for a couple of years, and because you'll talk to the people, you'll talk to your clients with a different attitude when you see how difficult it is to do. You won't be, you'll be more compassionate to what goes into it.
We talked about this a little bit earlier, the idea of level. I think that is such... The last two times we were here, you were here as a guest, this was the most incendiary topic that we talked about.
Yeah.
As the music business has progressed, the CDs are louder and louder. And it's hard to even understand what that means. Like, how can something be louder? But you can, if you transfer, let's say the Rolling Stones record from 1972, yeah, and then you transfer the CD burn of it from 1990, and then you transfer the Spotify, and you look at the waveforms, they look different. Yeah. One of them looks like what you said earlier, a ribbon. And every time they remaster a record, they make it louder, which means they make the lowest level parts of the record louder so that they can make the whole thing louder. So there's less dynamic range. A lot of people think this is a terrible thing, but then for mastering guys, there became a lot of pressure. Your records aren't as loud as the other guys' records. Is that that sounds crazy? Like
it is crazy. It is from a standpoint of music appreciation or music listening. It is crazy, but from the psychology of people that make records, it makes a certain amount of sense as to why that exists. Right, The guys in our there are three people in our trade that I can think of who do things. One guy's name is Spike Stent, a great engineer. He's an Englishman, and he lives in L.A. Actually, he lost his house unfortunately in the fires. Wow. He's a good guy. He's a friend of a really good friend of mine. Mixes really loud, super loud. There's a guy named Serban, these are guys who get paid the top level of money, and these guys all work super, super loud. So what happens is people who hire other engineers, they want their stuff to be commercially as successful as these projects that these guys get. Now, I'm going to try to make as much sense of this because it is kind of crazy, but just because a record is loud, it doesn't make it a hit. But in a playlist, if you're in a playlist with and your song is next to one of these ultra loud ones, in certain of the carriers, certain of the streamers, your record it won't be as loud, so it won't be as exciting. And the way people listen, again, the phone, the car, headphones, walking around, whatever, what you try to do is create impact, and now your thing seems a little flimsy. So some of the services compensate for that. So it's irrelevant.
I think Spotify is knocking every record down 2 dB or something like that. There's like a
6 dB knockdown if you don't change your phone. There's a preset on your Spotify.
Oh.
I wish I could show you later. There's a preset which takes away the maximization. If you take away the maximization, it sounds funny, but if you take away the maximization, everything gets more dynamic, and in some ways sounds a little bit louder. because you hear the mix more. But in playlists, if you listen to playlists all the time and you listen to a playlist with that setting, things won't sound consistent. So if you're at the beach and you're listening to something on your headphones, you know, you have to tweak it, whatever. It's so complicated, but it gets even more crazy because what happens is that a lot of times the bands will make a record without a producer, then they'll hire a professional. But when they had no producer, they'll have like a friend, and that friend will put this loud maximizer on. Now they have a rough mix. Then the rough mix, which is super loud. Now the guy who mixes it does his mix, and he doesn't do it loud. What happens? The band goes, the rough mix sounds more, it's more exciting. I said, no, it's not more exciting. It's just louder. Well, can you make mine more exciting and as loud as the rough mix? So it's called chasing the rough. Mm. This is what the mixers have to go through, right? Chasing the rough. Then it gets to me. Then I have to chase the mix, which has already chased the rough. So the whole thing becomes... I can't curse. There were words for this.
You're holding it back.
It's absurdity. So what I do, like I said, what I do earlier is I just try to get the creative people that I work for that trust me to get happy with what I give them, and you know, people have told me that wow, your stuff is really loud. I'm going like, wow, depends who mixed it. I don't have a theory about it. I know what I like. I know what dynamics do for me. But it doesn't matter. Everybody has to be happy. They paid their money. They put their time in. They have to be happy.
So are people in the past few years sending you records back saying, we love it, it's just not loud enough?
Usually if it's not loud enough, we hear about that when we're doing the reference part, the early part. Before it goes out, you know.
But that's what I mean. They're rejecting your first.
Yes. Yeah. Just like I worry. This band Beach House is an Indian. It's great. See, I would never know these bands just like you. You don't know them because it's all part of the environment right now, right? And this Beach House is like a very ambient, beautiful ambient vocals, very very airy and open and. And you know, the guy called me up. He says, "This is not as loud as something else." I go, "Like, well, you got to produce it differently if you want it to be loud. It's never going to be loud. It's not loud.
It's a ridiculous.
It's the most ridiculous." And that was one guy that I said to my manager. You know, I don't care. I'll say it on the air. I said, "I'm never working with that guy." This guy was like endless amounts of yap, yap, yap about this, something very, very basic and simple, which is irrelevant to his. I guarantee it. For people who want to listen to Beach House, they don't care about that.
Right. It's a strange, almost a random piece of. Thing to try to chase loud, you know, loudness.
There's an obsessiveness in the character of the people that make who are good at making music, which sometimes shoots them in the
artists box. Definitely have to go through a lot to, you know, I'm not giving anybody an excuse for bad behavior, but like, you know, your artistic temperament, as you said, like you're trying to do creative writing, it drives you crazy a little bit, right? Imagine working on, you know, your snare drum for 6 months or whatever. Let's talk about Todd Rundgren. You've worked with him a little bit, right?
I worked with Todd actually a whole bunch back. God, I guess it was more like 80s or into the early 90s. He ended up pretty much mastering his own stuff after a while. But with Utopia, he used to take some other projects. Trying to think of what there was a Canadian band that he worked on. But he would come in a lot. But he was I don't know how to describe
that
Todd.
This one?
Yeah,
this is a good record too.
I want to play Deface the Music, something off this. Or you want to hear the R.E.M. or Talking Heads?
Well, R.E.M. would be an interesting conversation. The Talking Heads would just be fun to listen to. I mean,
Ramones? I don't know.
I would say put an R.E.M. tune from that, from this. This is the record that came out before their Warner records, right?
Yeah, this came out on IRS,
yes.
The first EP. I think it's an amazing sounding record.
Yeah, this is, you know.
You remember working on this?
I definitely remember working on it, and then one of my good buddies Don Dixon worked on the Murmur and the other two albums, the first two REM albums. But I mean, what they were doing in those years was such a different band than what they actually became. Both all great. I mean, they've just been fantastic.
Yeah, well, this record sonically blew my mind when it came out. Yeah, nothing quite sounded like this.
Yeah.
Right, let's see if I queued it up right. There it is. Greg Calbi, we'll be back to talk with him just a little bit more after this. You know, this is the record that I bought at the record store in whatever it was, 1982 or 83 or whatever. So it's been played 5 million times, you know. And I'll bet that record on CD. I'm going to go home and and find a digital version of that, because I just can't imagine that it sounds the same as that does. I don't know.
It would be interesting, because that's definitely straight off the probably a quarter inch tape at that point. Then probably Mitch was on quarter inch at that point. So, but again, going back to the conversation we had a couple of minutes ago about drums. I mean, the drums sound great. That's, you know, Mitch Easter has a studio notorious for the millions of guitars, all kinds of drum kits. I mean, he's just one of the like rock and roll heroes. And you know, he and my friend Don Dixon produced the first couple REM albums. And I remember the lesson I always took from the first couple albums, even though I couldn't understand the lyrics for the most part, I was so shocked when later in their career, when Michael Stipe was so clear and the words were so vivid, you know, and yet they were a great band with a completely other sound, which was very mysterious, you know, what's he actually saying, and more of a musical instrument rather than actually a lyricist, you know?
They kind of lost me when his lyrics became intelligible, honestly. That's the exact turning point when they got rid of Don Dixon and Mitch Easter. They became a band they went from being literally one of my favorite bands to a band I didn't care at all about, but their early stuff is really important. Yeah. And it really kind of, I think, opened the door for a lot of, you know, that's the equivalent of garage bands for the 1980s.
Yeah.
Like REM, oh, we can do this. A lot of people heard that and said, right, you don't have to be Journey or Styx. You can do this.
Yeah.
You know, and that's super, super important, I think. So when somebody finishes, what percent of records did somebody send you after they finished working on them? Something that your name was on. Like, I'm curious. I mean, I know how many records you have in your house, but how many records and CDs?
Yeah, well, you know, not as many as I thought when I was prepping to come over here yesterday. I was looking through my records. I was really kind of shocked at how I have so many CDs, but the records I didn't have as many as I thought I had. And yeah, I was kind of a little disappointed, because I would like, you know, at this point I would actually like to go back and listen to some of the stuff. You know, it's not something that you could really, you could call the label and ask for a copy, and they would send you one if you wanted. But you know, the other thing is that you have no idea how many acetates I threw out that had a little mistake on them.
Ooh.
You know,
my God.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, some, you know.
Oh, my daughter's in college right now. We could use the money, Greg.
Damn the Torpedoes, Tom Petty. I know I had a bunch of those. If I would have saved those, I mean, because that was such a phenomenal recording. Great album, and I know, you know, I just know if I screw even part of a record, like I still have at home a Carl Wilson album that I worked on, and for some reason I always kept it. It was just one side of this Carl Wilson album, which I don't even know if it even came out. It might be a complete rarity. I don't have any idea. And I just had one side of it, and I couldn't believe that's all I had of acetates. I just never saved them. And you see them on people selling them all the time. It's like $800 for an acetate of blah, blah, blah.
Of course, yes.
And of course, the Sergeant Pepper. At that point, 1998, I wasn't cutting anymore, so I wouldn't have had an acetate of that. But there sure would have been a lot, you know, all the Ramones stuff and, you know, anything from that era, all the Heads and, you know, all that stuff. But, you know, just not what I did. It was, you know.
Yes, of course.
Not what I did.
You mentioned earlier a little bit about getting, let me switch gears. Before your generation of guys, which I'm going to talk about mid-70s, I don't think anybody knew the name of mastering engineers, right? Nobody cared who mastered a record. It wasn't even a concept of, like, that they were known people. These were like a short order cook or something. I don't know. You don't ask who cooked my hamburger, right?
Yeah.
But, like, all of a sudden, guys like you and this, you know, other guys that we've named became known people. Why? What happened? Did people start to value what mastering did?
Yeah, I think that I'm trying to just put the timeline in, like in the 60s, you know, especially like in England, during the Beatle era, there was no mastering. Everything was transferred. It was just really transferring it to an acetate, transferring it to a lacquer. It was a transfer process.
Just taking the tape and cutting the record with nothing in between.
Right. Yeah, just cutting it. You know, they mixed it, and then you're cutting it. Then there was a guy named Dominic Romeo, who I never met, who was pretty sure he was at Frankfurt Wayne, and he started doing like really hot singles. Now, when I say hot, this is an era where, for example, people listened in jukeboxes, and he was known that his records used to jump out on the jukebox. And the jukebox, you know, if you have young listeners, they probably think this is insane. But it really made a difference. If you were out at 2 o'clock in the morning and you try to play a jukebox and for a dime or 25 cents or whatever it was to make a play, sometimes you couldn't hear the record. You couldn't hear it. It was too quiet. But he was started to get like known, and the Honky Tonk Women was the one that I know he worked on. That's the one that was when this story was told to me about Dominic, right? So he was one of them. And then Bob Ludwig started at A&R, and Bob Ludwig he was a conservatory musician. I think he was a horn player. I think he was a trumpet player. But he came to A&R, and he went into the cutting room, and he started to, like, with the A&R was a top level studio on Broadway in New York City in the 60s, into the 70s, into the early 80s.
Phil Ramone, right?
That was Phil Ramone's studio, right? And he started to basically come up with some techniques to make the record sound louder and sound better, and he started to equalize a little bit. So he was the first person that I heard about.
So he deserved the name recognition.
Absolutely. Bob has always deserved every bit of credit that he got. He was, you know, the GOAT. You know, there was an article recently in one of the audio magazines. And, you know, he spent his time, and he put his money where his mouth is, started his own studio. But he was the person that I heard was the guy who was really good. And then George Marino, the guy who taught my friend Tom, who taught me how to cut, George was doing some great records. And apparently, like, Stevie Wonder, Inner Visions, and Talking Book, those records, they sounded so great. People started to see, like, wow, some of these records sound really great. Who mastered them, right? So I remember when I was at the cutting room, the first job that I had, I had a Moody Blues album came in. And the guy came in, Tony King, this guy came in, and he said to me, the only reason I'm here is because Bob Ludwig was booked. And that was like, okay, thanks for coming anyway, right?
Yeah, wow.
But so he was building his name up. George Marino was definitely building his name up. Lee Holko, who was the owner of Sterling, was also started getting a name because he worked on those great Cat Stevens records with Paul Samuel Smith. So records were coming out that sounded really good, and they sounded good because really great engineers were starting to realize that if they took control of who was going to cut their record, usually the label would be able to take control of that. So now the engineers were going like, oh no, you can't do that. Like at CBS, it was a union shop. So anything on Columbia or on CBS records had to be cut by the union guys there. The engineers who work would start work with them. Oh no, we're not using the union guy. So people would come in on a CBS job. The client would come in, and there would be some little old man there who was probably like 30 years younger than I am at this point. He would come with his little notebook, and he would just sit there and get paid because it was a union gig.
Huh.
So this is like moving from a production job to an actual creative job. So once you got a reputation as being a guy who could cut hot records or understand this kind of music or that kind of music, you know, and then once, you know, with R&B had its own personality. You know, although I did, you know, Luther Vandross, I did a bunch of records for Luther, and, you know, I had a couple of records, but that was never a main part of my thing. The main reason I had that was because Media Sound was across the street from Sterling, and it was so convenient. Just come on over, you know? So, the engineer started to have some juice in the process of who was going to be the creative team, but he would not be the guy paying you. The label would pay you. So he had to convince the label or the artist to spend extra money on this extra person.
Mm.
This is, to me, the most interesting thing about the mastering as a business. It's like your client is the person who brings the record over, is the engineer, the producer, the manager. None of those people are paying you. They have to convince this other entity, the label, or the money, to, okay, I did a great job, but it's going to be even better if you pay this guy $3,000 to master the record. So once this started happening, then every engineer had their favorite guy or their two favorite guys, right? And that really led, and that I would say that really started happening 1978 on.
Also around the same time, your name started to get on the
exactly,
records.
And exactly. So that's that was actually a good question. And so the growth of that. But now there's like 8 million guys because everybody can master,
What do you think? I mean, there are guys, and I mean, I don't think this is a rude question. What's the ballpark to go to Sterling Sound and master for an hour or a song or an album? I mean, can you give us that? It's public information, isn't it?
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean,
and I'm not saying your rate,
if somebody comes in with our guys, it's $500 an hour, and a record takes anywhere, depending on how it sounds, between 3 hours and 7 or 8 hours.
And then somebody is obvious. Someone's online. I can do it $100 a song, $50 a song, $25 a song.
$100.
And then have you messed around with these? There are programs now that
Lander
is one where you upload a song and they'll download three versions of it. Quote master. Or there are plugins that guys can just put on the output of their mix, like I can't remember, but I'm sure you've seen it. Have you messed around with these?
Yeah, they become part of our creative stream. I mean, a lot of there's new ones all the time.
Are they any good? Should people?
Some of them are really great. And this is what this is. You know, like one of these, the guys, Doug Sachs, I mentioned, you know, who passed away, who was at it for a long time. I remember about 7 or 8 years ago, everybody was bad mouthing these plugins. Oh, plugins are terrible, blah blah blah. And he was like, you got to listen to them, man. Some of them are really good. So we've incorporated Sterling. We've incorporated them into our workflow, and I definitely incorporated them.
So you use some of these automatic limiting or automatic?
I haven't done that. But all I could say is there's something to be said for almost anything that comes out. It just depends on how you weave it together to get a sound that you really like. But you can master a record at Sterling. I'm just going to throw a ballpark.
Sure.
Okay. You do an album at Sterling, it's going to cost you $2,500 to $3,000. You do a record for Joe Blow down the street, it'll cost you anywhere between $600 and $900. Okay. So what value are you getting for your extra $2,500? You financed the record yourself. You paid the musicians. You paid somebody to mix it. He maybe mixed it at home, whatever. You've already spent $12,000, $8,000, $10,000, whatever. Now, are you really, you think it's worth it to spend $2,500 for Sterling? It depends what you want, what your goals are for yourself. It depends on bang for the buck. I don't know how else to say it. Like, do you have more confidence in that record when you're talking to people about it because you spent more money on it to sound better? Does that project itself into how the record is perceived by the people you talk to who may be promoting it? A little bit more money because it doesn't really sound that good. Or somebody, you know, you do the record and somebody says, well, we really like the record, but it doesn't sound that good. Oh, no, if I would have just gone to one of the guys and spent a little bit more money. So this is the challenge of having a studio. Like we have a very, very phenomenal studio. We actually have three studios now. We have one in Nashville, two rooms down there. We have the four rooms in Edgewater, and we have another room that Ted Jensen has up in Hartford. These rooms are really expensive. We have a company that employs 32 people.
And the one in Edgewater, is it an old post office?
Yeah, it's a post office.
That's a cool building.
But the value of what we do can only come from the clients who value and can hear what we do and feel like it matters.
Well, it's funny. It's abstract, right?
Yes.
It's who knows what anything
exactly
is worth. But, yeah.
Exactly.
If you've got the money, it's not... it's going to make your project sound better.
Yeah.
We know that.
Yep. Would you have time for just one more comment?
Sure, of course. We got
all I can tell you is one of my favorite albums of all time is Peter Gabriel's So.
Okay.
Every song is a masterpiece. The first mastering of it is awful. It's terrible. It's spitty. It's thin.
Who did that?
I'm not mentioning who did it. All I can tell you is if people listen to the reissue of that, I had nothing to do with it on either end. I never worked on anything involving this particular record, and I would have loved to, but it's so much better. I mean, if somebody wants to understand the value of mastering, listen to the original that came out when it came out. Listen to the CD version, not the LP, and listen to the reissue, and you'll hear, you'll have a different experience. And that's what mastering should do.
All right, Greg Calvi, this is your third time visiting us. Folks can visit the archives to hear the other two versions. You know, we brought like 8,000 records. We played six records, but I really enjoyed our conversation. And
thank you, Michael. It was fun. It's always great to see you in and out of this particular studio.
Same to you. You're one of the world's nicest guys and, you know, top in his field. Folks, stay tuned. Rex is coming up next.